And now we have a special announcement from Tanya Kale.
Good morning. Our congregation was recently invited by Trinity Lutheran Church to help meet a need in the community. They had made note that there was no free hot meal provided in Kent on Saturdays. So starting Labor Day weekend, they started a Saturday hot lunch, and they're looking for other congregations in the Kent area to help with that. So right now, our congregation is looking to see if there's interest in participating, and if you're willing to help, perhaps cook or serve the meal, maybe every month or every other month. We're just trying to gauge interest. So if you are interested, you could send me an email or perhaps contact the church office. My name again is Tanya Kale. This opportunity was appealing to me as a parent because I think it's hard to find direct service opportunities we can do with our children. And this doesn't have any age limitations on it. So whatever age our children are, they could come and help in some aspect, maybe not using sharp knives, but they could help serve or, you know, other ways. So I'm hoping that we can sign up to do this. We're hoping to perhaps do an initial meal in November. We would be doing it there at Trinity Lutheran Church, and then depending on interest, we might do it in an ongoing way. Thank you.
Do you have an advertisement for the auction today?
We do.
Okay, step right up.
I'm alone, I'm unscripted, and I've had 3 cups of coffee this morning, so bear with me, okay? Sure, I can do that. Oh, I'm so loud. Okay, so question time. Where are you going to be Saturday, November 2nd? At the auction. Brilliant. Yay. That's what I wanted to hear. That is when our auction is. If you have no idea what I'm talking about, come find me. I'll explain it to you in more detail. We also have these brochures that you can have downstairs. The other thing is we have these lovely donation forms here. I know a lot of you have been giving those to us recently. Thank you. I love you for that. If you haven't, if you procrastinate about things like I do, I'm like queen of the procrastinators, if you still want to get one of these to us, we appreciate that. I know you all have talent and you'd love to share that with us, so that's basically all I've got here. So come see us at the auction.
Our chalice lighting this morning comes to us from the world of advertising, particularly Go RVing. Along with milk and vegetables, kids need a steady diet of rocks and worms. Rocks need skipping, holes need digging, water needs splashing, bugs and frogs and slimy stuff need finding.
Awaits a secret to be born.
Yale professor Stephen R. Keller, the preeminent scholar on the relationship between children and nature, a study called Biophilia, which actually refers to humans and nature, states, a child's optimal development, the emergence of a secure and positive identity, the ability to think critically and resolve problems, the formation of self-confidence and self-esteem, and a child's health and maturation continue to rely on beneficial interactions with the natural world. This relationship to nature must be engendered at home, in the classroom, and through personal experience and place-based learning. In addition, Keller says, children need to experience nature in various direct, indirect, and representational ways as an integral element of their everyday life at home, school, and at play. We must depart from the notion of nature as a place to visit in a park or forest, sequestered and apart from our normal existence. We must dispel the notion that formally structured and informally organized programs, whether at school or in the national forest, are the only antidotes for an increasing disconnect of children from the natural world. We need to appreciate that children also require unstructured, unmediated, even risk-prone opportunities for free, spontaneous, and often unsupervised contact with the natural world in the context of everyday life. We need to recognize that restoring children's contact with nature is not just about enhanced intellectual understanding and support for conservation, but also about the chance to experience a sense of wonder, joy, exuberance, awe, even fear and trepidation, all and more, the raw stuff of normal and healthy development. Finally, we need to realize that contact with nature is not just about direct physical contact in the outdoors and with living systems, but also is the representational and symbolic expression of the shape and pattern of the natural world revealed through story, picture, myth, legend, and more. I must confess, as a child living in a big city, I did not have many extended experiences with nature. When I was 5, my family moved to Madrid, Spain from San Juan, Puerto Rico, and there I do have vague recollection of palm trees, coconuts, interaction with geckos, iguanas, and other medium-sized slimy creatures. However, in Madrid, there were not an awful lot of green spaces, and I became much more adept at navigating the urban landscape, which I'm still quite good at. But every once in a while, my best friend would invite me to spend the family at his family's village home, and boy, what a great time we had there. We climbed trees and rocks. We got lost in the woods so many times. It was sometimes dangerous and always so cold and so great. And of course, I've never forgotten it. We invite you to consider your own reaction to nature as we explore the relationship between humans and the natural world. Come, let us worship together.
Our time for all ages this morning, The Courageous Life of Rachel Carson, was written by the Reverend Christy Anderson. This is a true story of a courageous woman named Rachel Carson, whose work has left a lasting legacy upon all of us and upon the earth. Rachel's work was so important that she was honored with a postage stamp and the Presidential Medal of Honor. Many school buildings are named after her, and she won an Academy Award for the best documentary, which was made based on one of her books. And she is listed by Time Magazine as one of the 20 most influential scientists of the 20th century. As a child, Rachel had two passions, exploring the out-of-doors and books. Rachel found that she could combine her interests by writing stories about animals and nature. Her first story was published in a national children's magazine when she was only 14 years old. Here she is shown reading a book to her dog, Candy. At first, Rachel thought she wanted to be a writer, but after taking some science courses, she realized that she wanted to be a scientist. In the early 1900s, it was very unusual for a girl to become a scientist. Many male college instructors were doubtful that she could handle the difficult courses, but she proved them wrong, and they grew to admire her intelligence and her scientific mind. It was hard for Rachel to find a job as a female scientist, so she took a job with the government where she studied the life patterns of ocean animals. Notice the photo of Rachel on the boat. At her feet is the heavy metal helmet that she wore underwater while scuba diving. Whenever she could find the time, Rachel wrote about her favorite topic, the life cycles of animals living along the ocean shore. Her essays were published in many magazines and in 3 books. Rachel's books were very popular as the public was eager to learn more about the mysteries of the ocean. Rachel earned enough money from the sale of her books that she was able to quit her government job and devote all of her time to studying and writing about nature. She was very adventurous for a woman of her time. As she explored nature, Rachel was noticing growing evidence of pollution. She wondered if the huge numbers of fish and birds dying were being harmed by chemicals that were sprayed to kill mosquitoes. Rachel began an intensive investigation and uncovered many worrisome facts, such as instances where baby birds weren't hatching from eggs in areas where chemical sprays were widely used. Rachel learned that the U.S. government supported the extensive use of spraying chemicals because it thought life would be better with fewer insects. From her studies, Rachel knew that all creatures are connected in the food chain and that killing off insects and if we kill off the insects, other animals would be impacted. Rachel contacted many experts and realized that chemicals being sprayed to kill insects were harming far more creatures than just the insects. She found that harmful chemicals were not only sprayed on farm crops, but they were sprayed on the animals that were the sources of human meat and milk. Spraying was also taking place in cities to combat mosquitoes. And spraying took place just about everywhere, even directly onto people. Based on the information she gathered, Rachel felt that it was important that she inform the public about this danger to humans, animals, and the environment. She knew that the companies that made the chemicals would strongly disagree with her findings, so she spent 4 years gathering evidence. In 1964, Rachel published the results of her research in a controversial book titled Silent Spring. As Rachel feared, the book greatly upset the companies that made these chemicals. Some said she was exaggerating the danger. Some even accused her of being a communist and plotting to destroy the United States economy. And some felt that a woman couldn't be a legitimate scientist. It was a very hard time for Rachel. She had worked alone and was not part of a university laboratory, so she had no one to stand up with her to convince the public of her concern. Rachel knew she had to fight to convince people to accept her warning about the overuse of chemicals. Rachel testified in front of Congress, made many speeches, and was interviewed on television shows. Finally, people began to believe Rachel instead of the chemical companies. Rachel did not live long enough to see many of the results of her work. She died 4 years after the publication of Silent Spring. Based on the research Rachel conducted, the government greatly restricted use of the most dangerous chemical, DDT. Wildlife that had been hurt by DDT, such as the eagles, eventually recovered. Rachel's work impressed President Kennedy, who formed the EPA, the government department charged with protecting the environment. And the government began requiring companies to test products for dangers before selling those products. But the most important legacy of Rachel Carson was her education of the public on how all of nature is interrelated and that we would have to be careful to avoid upsetting the balance of the natural world. Her courageous voice encouraged others to stand up and fight for the environment, such as Unitarian Universalist Danny Beale, who is seen in this photo holding the banner on the right side. In fact, Unitarian Universalism reflected Rachel's ecological spirit by adopting our seventh principle, honoring the interconnection of all living things to one another and to the earth.
I invite you to enter into a time of shared reflection upon nature's bounty. Although the lighting conditions in this room don't do justice to the photos of Brad Bolton, I hope that they will serve to stimulate your contemplation of the diversity and majesty of nature that abounds just within our locality. Each week, we take time to honor our church family and bring to mind the others in our lives for whom we care. Let us join together now in celebration of our joys and solemn recognition of our sorrows and losses. For any concerns that you would like to convey to our pastoral team, please enter them in the book found on the front table. We celebrate today the joyous news that Reverends Melissa and Evan Carvel-Zemer are the proud parents of son Rylan Alexander, who was born last Sunday. Melissa and Rylan are doing well. For the joys and sorrows that you would like to share with the congregation, I invite you to name aloud those for whom you are joyous and those who need our loving support. For the names mentioned aloud and for those we hold silently in our hearts, we pray that they find strength and comfort through the all-powerful presence of love. Let us enter into a time of prayer. Spirit of life and love, we offer deep and abiding gratitude for the miracles of life that abound. In our highly scheduled and hectic lives, it is all too easy to overlook the simple yet miraculous blessings that can grace our senses if we just remember to open our eyes and ears to the world beyond our inner self-chatter. May we find solace and renewal from the remembrance that our hearts beat with the rhythm of the earth. Each of us, as individuals and in community, are the living cells that sustain the body earth, which in turn nourishes each of its parts. May we be mindful of the beauty and mystery of the natural world. May we be thoughtful in our actions, and may we reach out to others in the spirit of oneness. Blessed be, and amen.
Through the eyes of a child, the sunrise of the universe, the morning becomes real. When the light touches ground, wondering at the sun as it journeys out across the earth, there's a sense of silence resounding with sound. In this big blue sky of open dreams, a child wonders why and hope takes wing. Life is so tame and so wild as we journey out across the earth. The sense of wonder is real when our hearts are unbound. We go dancing into the night, or fluttering off to find the words to express our shyness, withheld until now. In this big blue sky of open dreams, We open up our eyes and hope takes wing. Singing out to the sun, fleeting feelings we capture inside the words. When the beauty of love that surrounds is both real and surreal, can we capture the wonder and hold the beauty of oneness the wonder brings inside every spirit in the moment of now? In this big blue sky of open dreams, we open up our eyes and hope takes wing.
Rachel Carson was an award-winning writer who was recognized for her poetic imagery. She was able to convey scientific insights in understandable, beautiful, and compelling language. Silent Spring is distinctively different from her other writings. Its harsh, analytical tone was motivated by anger and the need to signal an urgent warning. Carson longed to finish Silent Spring and returned to her descriptive writing about the interconnected life cycles of creatures. She wanted to inspire an emotional connection with the natural world by stimulating curiosity and a sense of oneness with all of life by conveying beauty and mystery, unlike the cold facts she needed to present in Silent Spring. Her most intimate writing appeared in a magazine article written in 1958 on instilling a sense of wonder in children. The article was drawn from her experiences exploring nature with her grandnephew, Roger. Carson had a close relationship with Roger. He and his mother lived with Carson for his first 2 years and then spent summers with Carson. Following the death of Roger's young mother, Carson, at the age of 50, adopted 5-year-old Roger. Although delighted to have the opportunity to introduce young Roger and to the glorious bounty of nature she so deeply loved, to her surprise, Carson found that Roger's companionship opened her own eyes to new insights that she felt compelled to share with parents. The article on wonder was to be expanded into a more detailed book. However, the project was put on hold during the 4 years Carson researched and wrote Silent Spring, and time ran out before her additional thoughts were written in narrative form. The original article was republished after her death in book form with accompanying nature photographs under the title Sense of Wonder, which is still in print today. Christy will share the actual words of Rachel Carson from Sense of Wonder, as well as passages from two of Carson's speeches.
A child's world is fresh and new and beautiful, full of wonder and excitement. It is our misfortune that for most of us, that clear-eyed vision, that true instinct for what is beautiful and awe-inspiring, is dimmed and even lost before we reach adulthood. If I had influence with the good fairy, I should ask that her gift to each child in the world would be a sense of wonder so indestructible that it would last throughout a life, as an unfailing anecdote against the boredom and disenchantments of later years, the sterile preoccupation with things that are artificial, the alienation from the sources of our strength. If a child is to keep alive his inborn sense of wonder, without any such gift from the fairies, he needs the companionship of at least one adult who can share it, rediscovering with him or her the joy, excitement, and mystery of the world we live in. Parents often have a sense of inadequacy when confronted on the one hand with the eager, sensitive mind of a child and on the other with a world of complex physical nature, inhabited by a life so various and unfamiliar that it seems hopeless to reduce it to order and knowledge. In a mood of self-defeat, they exclaim, "How can I possibly teach my child about nature? Why, I don't even know one bird from another." I sincerely believe that for the child and for the parent seeking to guide him, it's not half so important to know as it is to feel. Once the emotions have been aroused, a sense of the beautiful, the excitement of the new and unknown, a feeling of sympathy, pity, admiration, or love, then we wish for knowledge about the object of our emotional response. Once found, it has lasting meaning. It is more important to pave the way for the child to want to know than to put him on a diet of facts he's not ready to assimilate.
Carson, never let weather conditions nor the clock deter her outdoor exploration. In fact, she regarded nighttime and rainy conditions as ideal times to indulge the curiosity of children.
We have let Roger share our enjoyment of things people ordinarily deny children because they're not inconvenient, interfering with bedtime, or involving wet clothing that has to be changed, or mud that has to be cleaned off the rug. We have let him join us in the dark living room before the big picture window to watch the full moon riding lower and lower toward the far shore of the bay, setting all the water ablaze with silver flames and finding 1,000 diamonds on the rocks on the shore as the light strikes the flakes of mica embedded in them. I think we have felt that the memory of such a scene, photographed year after year by his child's mind, would mean more to him in manhood than the sleep he was losing. One stormy autumn night, when my nephew Roger was about 20 months old, I wrapped him in a blanket and carried him down to the beach in the rainy darkness. Out there, just at the edge of where we couldn't see, big waves were thundering in, dimly seen white shapes that boomed and shouted and threw great handfuls of froth at us. Together, we laughed for pure joy. He, a baby, meeting for the first time the wild tumult of Oceanus. I, with a salt of half a lifetime of sea love in me. I do not pretend that Roger and I reacted with similar emotions, but it was good to see his infant acceptance of a world of elemental things, fearing neither the song of the wind, nor the darkness, nor the roaring surf. It was hardly a conventional way to entertain one so young, I suppose. But now, with Roger a little past his fourth birthday, we're continuing that sharing of adventures in the world of nature that we began in his babyhood. And I think the results are good. The sharing includes nature in storm as well as calm, by night as well as day, and is based on having fun together rather than on teaching.
According to Carson, nature was to be experienced through the senses on an emotional level. Sight is the primary receptor of the world around us, but Carson believed it was important to explore beyond the obvious.
There's a world of little things seen all too seldom. Many children, perhaps because they themselves are small and closer to the ground than we, notice and delight in the small and inconspicuous. We can share with them the beauties we usually miss because we look too hastily, seeing the whole and not its parts. Some of nature's most exquisite handiwork is on a miniature scale. As anyone knows who has applied a magnifying glass to an ice crystal, a good magnifying glass will bring a new world into being. Look at objects you take for granted as commonplace or uninteresting. A sprinkling of sand grains may appear as gleaming jewels of rose or crystal hue, or as glittering beads. A lens-aided view into a patch of moss reveals a dense jungle of strangely formed trees. Flowers, or any small creature, reveal unexpected beauty and complexity when aided by a lens. We can escape the limitations of the human size scale. Exploring nature with your child is largely a matter of becoming receptive to what lies all around you. It is learning again to use your eyes, ears, nostrils, and fingertips, opening up the disused channels of sensory impression. Take time to listen and talk about the voices of the earth and what they mean, the majestic voice of thunder, the winds, or the sound of surf or flowing streams.
Carson felt it was important to instill a solid sense of wonder in children, one that would continue to lift us to awe and curiosity as adults, despite life's distractions.
For most of us, knowledge of our world comes largely through sight. Yet we look about with such unseeing eyes that we're partially blind. One way to open your eyes to unnoticed beauty is to ask yourself, "What if I knew I would never see it again?" I remember a summer night when such a thought came to me strongly. It was a clear night without a moon. With a friend, I went out on a flat headland surrounded by the water of the bay. We lay and looked up at the sky and the millions of stars that blazed in darkness. The night was still. Only a few lights burned in cottages. Otherwise, there was no reminder of other human life. My companion and I were alone with the stars. I have never seen them more beautiful. The misty river of the Milky Way flowing across the sky, the patterns of the constellations standing out bright and clear, a blazing planet low on the horizon. Once or twice, a meteor burned its way into the Earth's atmosphere. It occurred to me that if this were a sight that could only be seen once in a human lifetime, this little headland would be thronged with spectators. But it can be seen many scores of nights in any year, and so the lights burned on in the cottages, and the inhabitants probably gave not a thought to the beauty overhead. And because they could see it almost any night, they may never see it.
For Carson, experiencing the wonder of the natural world was her solace and renewal from life's struggles. She believed that the sense of oneness evoked by the wilderness had the power to heal. Carson needed energizing, not only due to the mental exhaustion of defending her research and proclaiming her ecological message, but also to soothe the agony of her serious physical challenges that were hidden from public eye. Carson had surgery for breast cancer when she was 50. She struggled with multiple health issues periodically after that, not realizing until closer to her death that some of her problems were caused by the cancer metastasizing into her bones, which left her wheelchair-bound in her final months. When Carson spoke about the renewing power of nature, she was commenting on letters from fans, but certainly spoke from her heart as well.
Those who contemplate the beauty of the earth find reserves of strength that will endure as long as life lasts. There is symbolic as well as actual beauty in the migration of the birds, the ebb and flow of the tides, the folded bud ready for the spring. There is something infinitely healing in the repeated refrains of nature. The assurance that spring comes after winter, dawn after night. The lasting pleasures of contact with the natural world are not reserved for scientists, but are available to anyone who will place himself under the influence of earth, sea, and sky and their amazing life.
Carson's first book, The Edge of the Sea, was a layman's science primer on her beloved subject, life in the sea and on the shore. It was an astounding success. It was on the New York Times bestseller list for a record 86 weeks and was in first place for 32 of those weeks. Carson came to realize that the popularity of the book was more than just the public's yearning to learn about ocean life. She discovered that the restorative power of nature she experienced resonated with others as well.
After my book was published, I began to receive a great deal of mail from people of all ages and both sexes and all degrees of education. They've made it clear that men and women in all walks of life are responding in a surprising way to what I've written about the Earth. They are finding in it something that is helping them face the problems of these difficult times. That something is, I think, a new sense of perspective on human problems. When we contemplate the immense age of earth and sea, when we get in the frame of mind where we can speak easily of millions or billions of years, and when we remember that the short time that human life has existed on Earth, we begin to see that some of the worries and tribulations that concern us are very minor. People everywhere are desperately eager for whatever will lift them out of themselves. I'm sure that such release from tension can come through contemplation of the beauties and mysterious rhythms of the natural world. I believe this affinity of the human spirit for the earth and its beauties is deeply and logically rooted. As human beings, we are part of the whole stream of life. Since life arose many hundreds of millions of years ago, it has developed, struggled, adapted itself to its surroundings, and evolved in infinite number of forms. But its living protoplasm is built of the same elements as air, water, and rock. Our origins are of the earth. And so there is in us a deeply seated response to the natural universe, which is part of our humanity.
Carson's public discourse on the relationship of life to its environment resulted in recognizing her today as the founder of the ecology movement. As a prophetic voice speaking to a populace enthralled with new technologies that gave humans greater control over the natural world, Carson proclaimed, "Man, far from being the overlord of all creation, is himself part of nature, subject to the same cosmic forces that control all other life. Man's future welfare and probably even his survival depend upon his learning to live in harmony, rather than in combat with these forces." Although this sentiment reflects our worldview today, this was a revolutionary statement in the early 1960s.
As a child and throughout her early adult years, Carson was inspired by her unbounded sense of wonder. However, as she studied animal life along the coast and eroding seashores, she witnessed the impact of human activity on her beloved world and became outraged by the human arrogance, corporate greed, and political insensitivity. Despite this, Carson retained an optimism, believing that our ability to nurture wonder and awe of nature's beautiful interrelationships would engender a loving connection to the natural world that would ultimately save the earth, as we would not destroy that which we love. 50 years later, there are people who agree with this perspective and are working to inspire a spirit of oneness with earth. We close with a brief video that reflects the pioneering philosophy of Rachel Carson. This clip is a small part of the 19-minute short film, which was created to raise funds to make an expanded full-length documentary promoting planetary unity by a group called Planetary Collective. These filmmakers and the astronauts interviewed would probably agree with Rachel Carson's observation that, quote, "We must become mature enough to see ourselves as a very tiny part of a vast and incredible universe, a universe that is distinguished above all else by a mysterious and wonderful unity." May we follow in Rachel Carson's insightful footsteps. For the sake of time, we're going to omit the hymn of affirmation, and so I'd like to call the ushers forward for our offering. As the ushers come forward, I'd like to draw your attention to the cover of the Order of Service. The photo features the late Dr. Gordon Vars, an educator and longtime beloved member of this congregation, and a leading advocate for the preservation of the Kent Bog. Gordon's wife, Alice, shared the photo and offered these words. "Gordon is pictured here with our four grandchildren on our back step in Kent around 1982, studying a picture book of nature. He would next lead them into the yard to discover friendly spiders, ants, and plants to protect and appreciate. They do not forget later in life the Kent Bog and the appreciation, importance, and preservation of our planet and life. Go now in peace.